Greenwood had a pop. Woodward spilt it. And guess who's there? Close your eyes. And he never went away. Cristiano Ronaldo has stolen back the show.
When arguably the world's most popular athlete took the pitch last weekend for arguably the world's most popular soccer club, two overwhelmingly global entities, Cristiano Ronaldo and Manchester United, reunited on the legendary grounds of Old Trafford. The same place that was stormed by United supporters just months earlier in revolt against the globalization of the sport they love. Today, Wright Thompson, who was there for Ronaldo's return, takes us inside the fight for the soul of a team and a city and the world it birthed. I'm Pablo Torre. It's Friday, September 17th. This is ESPN Daily. Wright Thompson, thanks for coming back on the show, my friend. I appreciate it.
No, man, it's my pleasure.
So I've been waiting for this. I've been waiting for this because I follow you on Instagram, and I've been waiting to see what your brain would do with seemingly weeks in Manchester, England, right? And I was jealous. I'm jealous that I didn't write this. I'm jealous that I didn't get to report this.
I mean, it was a privilege to be at the game just because, as you know, traveling around the world, going to big sporting events that matter in the places where they're happening is incredible. And the energy was something. But just being in a city like Manchester that, for all intents and purposes, is where the modern world began was also a real privilege. And I just loved being there. And I really like Manchester.
Yeah, your affection for the city, right, really comes through in how you write about what is now the city's most famous export, Manchester United, this club that has millions and millions of adoring fans all around the planet at this point. These people who wear these iconic red uniforms and who dream about visiting Old Trafford, the stadium with more than 100 years of history. But the real story here is also about the increasingly vast disconnect, right, between a team that is now a brand and the people of Manchester itself. So I wanted to see if you could just start by giving us a quick history lesson of how Man United, which was first formed in 1878, how that club became so important to the city it calls home.
You have to understand that Manchester United was founded in the industrial north, working class neighborhoods. People who don't live in them would call them slums. Some people who do live in them would call them slums, but like really hardworking neighborhoods north of the city center of Manchester. So if you think about the first Manchester United fans, they were the people who lived in these working class neighborhoods. Mostly Irish, mostly Catholic, almost exclusively factory workers, mill workers, what the English would call working class, what we would call blue collar. I mean, some of these stats are just incredible. Only 57% of children lived until their fifth birthday. The weight of an average 17-year-old mill worker shrank to 104 pounds. Nobody went to school. You know, one of the reasons soccer was invented is because you had people who had never saw the sun.
And why were conditions like that in Manchester? What is it about the city's history that is so significant here?
Manchester is where, you know, cotton became king. You have the first looms being made around the turn of the 19th century, a little before they realized that a machine could weave faster than four people.
It was, in truth, a complete transformation in the English way of life. Villages became towns. Towns became cities. And manufacturing was transferred from quiet homesteads to factories. This transformation we call the Industrial Revolution.
One of the things that's important to understand is that from around 1800 to, say, 1930, cotton was what oil is now. And so, you know, the cotton was grown, you know, mostly in the American South. It was shipped to Liverpool and then brought to Manchester to be turned into stuff. The first global economy started with these factories in Manchester, And there is no understanding Manchester United without understanding that it was first loved by the people who worked in the world's first factories and upon whom the Industrial Revolution was built. It's interesting that the peak Manchester population was 1931. And so this huge city has been in some sort of decline ever since.
And so 1931, right? This is only like a decade or so before Britain enters World War II. So how was the city of Manchester affected by the war?
Manchester, being an industrial center, got the bombed out of it.
The flames of war eat at the heart of Manchester. In one of the fiercest raids of the German Blitzkrieg on Britain, a storm of bombs wreaks havoc in this proud city.
And if you see these pictures from the Blitz, they're these huge flames. And it's because you realize they were bombing cotton warehouses, which is full of cotton seed. All of it is incredibly flammable.
They were a target because of how important they were to the economy.
100%. After World War II, the government started clearing these slums and moving people out. They literally were picking up streets of people and moving them out. Places like Colleyhurst, places like Miles Platting. You know, these are neighborhoods where they exist mostly now in memory and on message boards and the internet. And you cannot separate the love people have for the team from these neighborhoods.
You identify a moment in 1958 where there is a turning point that makes this connection between a place and a people that much more visceral. What happened? How do you describe that?
On February the 6th, 1958, the Manchester United football team crashed in Munich right outside the airport.
On the fringe of a Munich airport lies the wreckage of an airliner. In that plane were a group of young men who were almost the personal friends of millions. Manchester United, the finest soccer team Britain has produced since the war.
The plane crashed and 23 died. It's hard to overstate how devastating that was in the city of Manchester. You know, you talk to Manchester United fans of a certain age, and some of them cry now, 70-year-old men, talking about walking into their little houses, two ups, two downs, and seeing their mother folded up on the floor crying.
Manchester, from the moment the news came through, was a city in mourning. Newspapers sold as fast as they could be printed. It was as though every family in a city of 750,000 people had suffered a personal loss, and so indeed they had.
In Manchester, you always have to sort of pull the string of the past and see where it leads. So 1958 is only 13 years after the end of the war. England didn't have the booming economic response to World War II that America had. We emerged triumphant. They crawled through the mud and the gore and survived. Those are very different experiences. And so in 1958, you just had a city starting to sort of look to the future again. And then there is this plane crash. They brought the bodies back to Old Trafford in the dark, and there were 30,000 Mancunians standing out there in the rain, just a vigil. You know, this idea that we can't leave those beautiful young boys in that place alone all night. And you had this sense that they were going to rebuild this team. Modern Manchester United, the club we think about today, was really born from the team that rose from the ashes of that plane crash.
So to rebuild this team, which had just been decimated by tragedy, the club looked to where it had always looked for players in the working class neighborhoods of Manchester. And I mean, you write in your piece that they used to send scouts around to like the local schools and churches.
So sort of the mother church, if you will, of Manchester United was a church called St. Patrick's, and it is right there in the center of Colleyhurst. And, you know, the longtime headmaster was a player for Manchester United. You had Nobby Stiles, who was a star on the 1966 England World Cup team.
Nobby Stiles, the young white half. Going to on his own now with a great chance. Stiles is there. He drives it. What a goal!
Was a member of the 1968 Manchester United European Cup team. We call that now the Champions League. Brian Kidd, who also was on that 1968 team.
Kidd. Oh, brilliant bit of work by Kidd. It's a goal, a great goal.
I mean, these are guys from Collyhurst, from St. Patrick's. And so you had scouts going into these churches and schools finding players. I mean, if you look at the 1968 Manchester United roster, every single person on that team is from England, Ireland, or Scotland. And they are all working class guys who went to school at places like St. Patrick's. A lot of these things might feel like ancient history if you're a new fan to Manchester United, but like it isn't, and there's a very straight line. Brian Kidd and Nobby Stiles, who were both from St. Patrick's and Collyhurst, were the youth coaches for the very famous class of 92. Which is David Beckham and Gary Neville and all of those guys. So when you think about David Beckham, who is as a modern celebrity football player as they come, his youth coaches were two guys from the Irish Catholic slums of Manchester who told him what it meant to play for Manchester United. When Ronaldo was coming up in the club, you know, the elder statesmen for him were those men who had been coached by Nobby Stiles and Brian Kidd. And so there is a very straight line from the plane crash in Munich to Cristiano Ronaldo.
All right, right. After the break, I want to follow that straight line from the working class people of Manchester to now a global billion-dollar brand.
Now let's talk about the play of the week. The pressure to follow up Hypnotic and Cognac weighing heavy on the team. Hypnotic was in the cup, blue, and ready for the play. And boom, Añejo Tequila came in with the smooth assist to Hypnotic's tropical fruit finish. Shaken, strained, poured. It was green and good. The playmaking splash shifted the tempo. Another great cocktail from the Hypnotic team. Every season is Hypnotic and Tequila season. Hypnotic Liqueur, Bardstown, Kentucky. 17% alcohol by volume. Hypnotic reminds you to think wisely, drink wisely.
So for much of this club's existence, right? I mean, Manchester United was the people of Manchester. They were fused. They were one. They shared that soul. But now, you know, you look at Forbes and this is the team that is valued at $4.2 billion. So the trajectory economically of the club in that way, how does that happen?
Well, yeah, I mean, it used to be if you wanted to go to a Manchester United game, you got on the 112 bus outside St. Patrick's and you took it to Old Trafford. You just would show up and get a ticket. But television in the early 1990s and the birth of the modern Premier League meant that you could watch Manchester United from your house anywhere in the world. And if you've ever been to a game at Old Trafford or seen one on TV, all of those super complicated, fierce ideas about this tribe are somehow communicated by the experience of watching them, and people at home understood it. Everybody from outside of Manchester understood what that name on your shirt meant, and people wanted it.
It's Beckham.
You also have to understand that the first dominant team of the television age was Manchester United, and it was those men from the class of 92, David Beckham, Gary Neville, Scholes, all those guys.
Beckham! Oh! Beautiful goal!
They were the first global superstars of soccer. What nobody watching really knew is the deep Collyhurst roots that were behind them. I mean, one of the things that's so interesting is that the same forces of globalization, which, study after study tell us cause severe alienation, that were pressing on the traditional Man United fans, were also creating alienation all over the world. We have study after study that says that people are desperate for something to belong to, desperate for a tribe. So it's sort of a mind when the same forces that are pressing down on the traditional Man United fans and pricing them out of this thing that for generations had been a birthright are the forces that are driving those new consumers to want something like Man United to begin with.
Yeah, and one of the biggest things that seems to have alienated and infuriated the traditional Man United supporters is the club's current ownership. So explain how they came in and why they've upset so many.
So in 2005, Malcolm Glazer, you know, who owned and whose family now owns the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, completed his purchase of Manchester United. And he had to borrow a lot of money to get that done. And so the fans, correctly in hindsight, understood that debt service combined with what I imagine are pretty nice quarterly dividend checks didn't leave a lot of space for the thing to continue being a vessel for all the complicated things they'd put in it. And so, you know, the anger at the Glazers was immediate and strong and also deeply tied to the idea that they were seen as vanguards of these, you know, forces of international financiers and globalization.
Well, right. They're Americans.
I mean, they are Americans, but I think it's less than that, that they are people who live a life without borders. They don't have to have a sense of place. If they want the most precious thing in the city of Manchester, they can buy it. If they want this thing in Tampa Bay, they can buy it.
Manchester United in this time, now we're in the present tense, right? They are also fighting off Manchester City. And so the crosstown rival here, which has its own ownership group that is worth discussing, tell us about how this arms race is developing.
So if you are an 18-year-old living in the city of Manchester, you have no memory of Manchester United being the most dominant football team in the city, which is insane.
Yes.
If you consider the history. You know, you talk to older people and they'll tell you that, you know, if they think about their class at school, 9 of 10 people were United fans and 1 of 10 was a City fan. And so, you know, Man City has really come on. They are owned by the state of Abu Dhabi. And it puts the owners of Manchester United in a very difficult spot, because how do you compete with people who have unlimited money and who aren't trying to run a business?
And you're in debt, incidentally.
Yeah. And, you know, you didn't buy this thing because you love Manchester United. You bought this thing because it seemed like a way to get a good return on investment, which is perfectly legitimate and very, very smart. You just happen to have bought something that is both sacred to people who already feel bludgeoned and is now having to compete with a nation state who is using it to sort of hold the shiny thing up in one hand so nobody really looks too closely at their human rights issues in the other.
That's right.
It is a very unenviable position to be in the city of Manchester, especially in working class Manchester. You have had, for about the same amount of time as the Premier League has been blowing up on television, you have had a very strong parallel, but not unrelated, continuing spasm of anger against the forces of globalization.
And all of those forces, right? I mean, this all comes to a head in May of this year, because the European Super League, RIP, you know, how that agitated and stoked what felt like a populist revolution in this city. Tell us about the dynamic for those who aren't familiar.
So 12 of the super clubs in England and Spain and Italy decided to get together and essentially form what an economics professor would call a cartel, which is no one else can have access to this. No one can be relegated from it. We will play each other. And it felt like where all of this had been heading all along to these fans, which is the end of local leagues and the beginning of super clubs who exist without borders. And so people were righteously pissed. And Man United fans, which I think is very interesting because that's the city where all of these forces were first put out into the world, were the most pissed.
Oh my God. United!
They stormed the field at Old Trafford and they had to postpone the Liverpool game. They broke into the stadium and stopped the game. And what's really interesting and what they would tell you, I think, is they didn't stop the game. They stopped a television show. And what was happening in Manchester suddenly mattered a great deal to a control room in London, to a control room in New York City, to a control room in Hong Kong. People feel like a group of outsiders trying to make money have monetized their memories of their mothers crying, listening to the radio, hearing news of a plane crash in Munich, and that they are now being asked to pay more and more for what used to be their own memories, and many of them are finding that they don't have the money for it, and those that do have the money for it don't have the stomach for it.
So there is this uprising, essentially. Against the forces of globalization in soccer, there is this enormously messy backlash, right? With Manchester now the epicenter of it. And then last month, probably the single biggest global icon in the entire sport suddenly becomes available on the open market. How does Cristiano Ronaldo, a guy who basically began his pro career with United more than a decade ago, but a guy who seemingly would also represent everything those old school United fans would hate. How does that guy wind up back at Old Trafford?
He is looking to leave Juventus, and there's a lot of speculation that he will land at Manchester City. That just would have been a bridge too far, frankly, for United fans. If their club didn't have the money or the wherewithal to go after a player who'd gotten his start at United, who long talked with deep affection about United, if that guy was allowed to go to Man City, then what really are we doing here? And so United just couldn't let that happen.
But right, what's so on the nose about this is that when you talk about a stateless entity, Ronaldo and his celebrity and how it is transcendent in all of these ways.
Ronaldo is, more a corporation than a person. My favorite stat is that he has 14 million more Instagram followers than there are human beings in the United States.
No, right. It's remarkably jarring to be like, I think I have a good handle on who famous people are. And then you see that Cristiano Ronaldo has over 340 million Instagram followers. I didn't know that number could fit on the page. He might be the most famous person on the planet.
He's definitely in the top five, and I would argue that he's the most famous person on the planet.
Yeah.
And his whole lifestyle is made possible by the fact that he can just bounce from nation to nation.
Yes.
Whoever has the biggest paycheck. A sub-zero refrigerator keeps his ionized water the same temperature, whether it's in Turin or Manchester or Madrid.
And so that guy, the guy who started his pro career with Man United in 2003, the guy who played there till 2009 before leaving for Real Madrid and becoming the guy astride global soccer capitalism, he is now with Man United once again. And how does the city react to that news?
Those traffic signs that tell commuters like how long the wait is? Those traffic signs in Manchester, when I got there on Thursday, said, "Welcome home, CR7. The place is going crazy. They're selling $50, $60 million worth of jerseys. You can't buy, the jerseys were sold out. I went to the team store, they were out of them. The anxiety produced by the Super League and the hope produced by the signing of Ronaldo, as opposed to being contradictory, are actually sort of the same thing. I mean, if you go back to the history of the club, if you go back to Munich, it has always been about mourning something that was lost, fearing something that might be lost, and hoping that something new and beautiful might rise again. I mean, that's the thing that ultimately I finally understood, was that these things I saw as being in conflict have always been in concert.
All right, so with Cristiano Ronaldo making his return to Old Trafford this past weekend, and you there to watch him, I need to ask you about what the atmosphere and the scene was like after the break.
Delicious meat, nutritious. In the snack that packs a real protein punch, Wonderful Pistachios, one of the highest protein nuts out there. Each 1 ounce serving has 6 grams of protein, giving you over 10% of your daily value. Trust me, I've been eating them like there's no tomorrow all week. Wonderful Pistachios also come in a variety of flavors and sizes, perfect for enjoying with your family and friends or taking them with you on the go. And you, like me, are on the go a lot. Taking the kids to school, hopping from meeting to meeting, shopping for groceries, whatever it may be. Well, the good news is, not only are Wonderful Pistachios a complete protein providing all 9 essential amino acids, they're also great for all your adventures. So whether you're a pistachio purist who loves cracking open every nut, or you prefer the convenience of no-shells pistachios, Wonderful Pistachios has got you covered. Grab Wonderful Pistachios and elevate your snack game today. Visit WonderfulPistachios.com to learn more.
Okay, this is where my jealousy reaches a fever pitch, right? Because Cristiano Ronaldo, the world is, the literal entire world, you could argue, is more focused on this sporting event than any other at the time. And so here he is at Old Trafford with his old club this past weekend. You're in the middle of it. You're there. You got good seats for this. What was the scene like?
It was a privilege to be at, honestly. It was nuts. They started singing before the game. I mean, we heard them a couple of blocks away, and the fans sang through the entire game. I mean, it makes the hair stand up on your arm. It's primal. It's like going to the Coliseum. Been very lucky to go to a lot of cool stuff, and I mean, I don't ever take it for granted. This was as loud a place as I've ever heard. I was the fifth row off of the pitch.
Right, we found a YouTube video of one of the goals that I think it was the second goal that Ronaldo scored.
We're going to play in Ronaldo. It is Ronaldo. It's 2-1 United. The theatre lives its dream. A phenomenon.
And there you are, of course, in your right Thompsonian hat. And I don't think you're celebrating in the still shot that we have, but it's absurd.
I mean, I was taking notes, probably, hopefully. I mean, you can go watch. If not, I'm in a lot of trouble.
Your ethics journalistically were intact, is what
that's good.
My point
that's
is.
Good.
Yes.
That's good.
So basically, as sporting events go where a championship is not on the line, this is basically as big as it gets, pretty much. We're talking about the vertical integration of a multinational corporation of a human being, right? And his old employer, this literal multinational corporation, and they're having a giant party. But amid the party, there is something that forces fans to reckon with Ronaldo's history. What happened?
As you, I'm sure, saw on television, you know, but there was an airplane.
Yes.
Circling the stadium. And there's a banner flying over the stadium that says, "Believe Catherine Mayorga," who is the woman in Las Vegas who has accused Cristiano Ronaldo of rape. And after an investigation, no charges were filed. But a group wanted to make sure that people didn't just have the ecstasy of the day without having to confront the complication of their own joy.
But as you explain in your piece, it doesn't really sound like that much of a complication for the people there. I mean, you're right that when the plane appeared, the fans started singing, "Viva Ronaldo," and then they pretty much ignored it until it flew off.
Not only are people just, it's not like they're just trying to pretend like none of this is going on. It's just like a brazen, we don't really give a shit. And that was pretty shocking to see up close. And, you know, those things we were talking about earlier about, these are very old, contradictory, complex things being expressed in public. And that was the most clear when seeing the reaction to the airplane.
So all of these contradictions, right, which are genuinely worrisome, they say a lot about all sports fans. But in this case specifically, how do you make sense of Cristiano Ronaldo being the opposite of what these people want to be and also being the very thing they want more than anything else right now?
Everything lives in the contradictions. We get into trouble when we try to say capitalism good, Marxism bad. Marxism good, capitalism bad. Everything exists on a spectrum. I mean, you know, we have jobs working for a publicly traded company, and God bless them, you know? And like in many, many instances, the Manchester School is correct and comparative advantage is correct. And the rising tide does raise many, many boats. But there are also lots of people chewed up in that. And the descendants of many of those people happen to cheer for a very specific soccer team that used to be located in the north of Manchester and is now the most famous soccer team in the world. The idea that if the soccer team is the vessel, if the soccer team is successful, then you are successful. And everything else is just something that some on a podcast is saying.
Yes.
You know, I am over-intellectualizing something that is incredibly simple. And that is the feeling in that stadium is more important than any attempt to articulate why it happened or what it meant. Long after those articulations are gone and forgotten, the feeling will remain in the people who felt it.
Even if those same people, right, cannot afford to feel those feelings in person, and they can't even go to church with those players in the way that sparked the entire love affair in the first place.
Especially if.
Right, Thompson, thank you for telling us about Manchester and the history of our world.
That's it. That's all. My work here is done.
I'm Pablo Torre, and this has been ESPN Daily. Our show is produced by Alexander Hyacinth, Mike Johns, Steve Martin, Ryan Nantel, Mike Philbrick, Andy Tennant, Eve Tro, Chris Tuminello, and Aaron Vale. Special thanks this week to Andre Soto, Julia Faust, Eve Wolf, Jennifer Thorpe, Isabel Lopez, and Jackson Augello. I'll talk to you Monday.